What we're doing, of course, is to use a very, very clean quantum system, this neutron interferometry, to try to build some intuition about the complexity of physics. And really, you know, we could sort of think about this as building our intuition one qubit at a time. So far we've got one qubit, and we'll look at what can happen with it. And what we saw was that one of the interesting complexities to dynamics is to have a distribution of dynamics. And so we defined the action over a density matrix. That was averaged over some classical probability distribution of some unitary process. And Z is just a dummy variable over this. And we saw that we could describe this. It's not the most general thing that can happen, but it's an important piece of the physics. And we saw that we could replace this with a superoperator description, so that we could say that rho out tilde is equal to a superoperator rho zero. I'm going to put the tildes there because this is a columnized version of a density matrix. So if we have a density matrix, rho, we know that we could write it in full generality in terms of the Pauli basis. And then we could columnize that. And the superoperator acts on that columnized version. And it tells us how each element, each Pauli element of the density matrix is mapped to other elements over this. And this, of course, is easy to calculate. We can calculate it directly with this equation by putting in here the Paulis. So I can put in Pauli identity X, Y, Z. Of course, I get out some density matrix. And then I can take the overlap of this with the density matrix with the element of the Pauli I want to see. And then we can, you know, 16 calculations, 16 elements. Life is good. We get a compact representation. Of course, there's a penalty for this compact representation. We lose this description, right? But we get a piece of it that we can work with very easily. And we saw that there's a second, even maybe nicer piece that we can describe rho of t in terms of Krauss operators. And for these Krauss operators, we just need a number of the dimension squared of Krauss operators. And again, we made a simplification of this. We said for our purposes it will be enough to look at the Krauss operators in this particular picture, where each operator actually corresponds to a unitary, and that there's a probability, so P sub k is a probability of that particular action. And I didn't say last time, but in order to get a really compact, clean, beautiful description of this, go and read John Preskill's notes, where he describes this in full generality. So John is a physics professor at Caltech. He's written a beautiful textbook, which I think he still hasn't published, but you can download it from his website. and on quantum information. And it is lovingly compact. You don't have to wade through anything. Everything that's important is there, and nothing that isn't important is there. So have a look. Okay. Now, we went through an example of this to look at a dephasing model, which is something that you had gone through with Daniel. And it's nice to give you one more example looking at block equations. So we know that if we have a qubit, then we can map the qubit to the block sphere. And if we map the qubit to a block sphere, then unitary dynamics lives on the surface of the block sphere, and all open system dynamics lives on the interior of the block sphere. Okay? And if you have a qubit, then we can have a very general description of the dynamics, and that's in terms of the block equations. And the block equations describe what happens to the expectation values of a qubit. And block equations were originally described for magnetic resonance, but they're general for any qubit. Okay, so we use them for every time we see a qubit. And it's interesting to take a moment. Bloch and Purcell share the Nobel Prize for discovering NMR. And they both were working at the radiation lab at MIT during the war. And so during World War II, they were young, they developed some physics. They, of course, learned an awful lot about RF electronics. And then after the war, Purcell goes back to Harvard, Bloch goes to Stanford, and they do this experiment to look at nuclear magnetic resonance. So look at what happens when you place an ensemble of nuclear spins in a strong magnetic field. Now, Bloch, you know of for the Bloch wave function, right? Bloch was very important in the development of quantum mechanics. Purcell, you might know of for his book on E&M. He's a classical spectroscopist. Done a lot of things, but if I overgeneralize him, you know, he's the classical guy who blocks the quantum guy. And yet when they publish their papers, Purcell publishes a quantum description in terms of perturbation theory and effectively Fermi's golden rule. Bloch publishes the classical description. And it's a little bit surprising. So why is the quantum guy publishing the classical description? But it's often forgotten that not only does he publish the classical description, he proves that there's an isomorphism between SU2 and O3. He shows that, in fact, the Bloch equations are a complete description of what happens to a qubit. And so that's the way we're going to treat them now, is that they're a complete description of what happens to the expectation value of a qubit. And so we can write them down. And I should try to get my signs right. Okay, so there's a few terms in the Bloch equations. The first one is this frequency that is defined by Hamiltonian, the Zeeman Hamiltonian, which in Bloch's original paper is the interaction of the spin magnetic moment with an applied external field. But in general, it simply says that there's a quantization axis for the qubit. There's a preferred direction, so we have some direction in space that the qubit is quantized about. And we're going to keep that as a special direction. And it could be anywhere in space, right? If we're looking at flux qubits, we'll see later on that by setting the experimental parameters, we can make this point anywhere. And fine, all you need to do is rotate your description to that preferred orientation, right? So a simple similarity transform gives you that dynamic. And then there's two relaxation times, T1 and T2, which are generally treated as phenomenological, but were defined correctly non-phenomenologically by Bloch. The reason that there's two relaxation times is that if, so let's describe the dynamics. It says here we have a set of three coupled differential equations for the expectation values. It says that, of course, x and y rotate into each other, right? And it says that x and y decay in the xy plane to zero. And it also says that z, the expectation value of z, decays to zero. Now, it's often included here a term that would say it returns to some equilibrium value, right? And so this is a number, right? But we don't need to do that. We can say, oh, yeah, the whole thing decays. And so if we had a vector somewhere in the xy plane, somewhere on the Bloch sphere, then it would spiral, and it wouldn't spiral like that. I should get it right. We have some vector here. It would spiral about the z-axis, and it would decay to the fully mixed point, which of course is the interior, is the origin of this, right? And it would decay with two time constants, one time constant to say, hey, how much information is left in the xy plane, and another time constant that says, do you get back to the origin, right? And the reason these two are different is the z-axis we said is important. We said the z-axis defines the energy. So the only way we can change the state along the z-axis, we can change that projection, is actually to give or take energy from the system. Whereas there's no energy penalty. There's our Hamiltonian. There's no energy penalty along the x and y direction. So we're free to do anything we like there. Okay? Now then, let's look at this in terms of our Krauss operators. So in terms of the Krauss operators, we'll look at a really simple picture for the Krauss operators. Last time what we looked at was dephasing, noise along the z-axis. But of course that commutes with the Hamiltonian. So the reason I want to do this is to look at a noise that does not commute with the Hamiltonian. So we'll put noise along the x-axis. Now we know how the system evolves. And so we can stick our density matrix in there, and we can say, oh yes, rho is a function of d2, right? Just looking at the evolution infinitesimally, okay? So rho is a function of dt is equal to 1 minus dt over twice t1, the identity rho, the identity. This is rho of 0, of course. And it's plus t over twice t1, sigma x, rho of 0, sigma x. And we want to reconstruct the block equations, so we're interested in looking at the time evolution of the density operator. So I'll just subtract the operator from here, and of course the identities don't matter, so we'll have minus rho of 0 over twice t1 plus sigma x rho of 0 sigma x over twice t1. And very compactly and quickly we see that, of course, if we took sigma x as our initial state, okay, then of course it's a constant of this motion. If I took sigma y or sigma z of that state, both of them are going to decay. So here we have d sigma x dt is equal to 0, d sigma y dt is equal to minus sigma y over t1, and d sigma z dt is equal to minus sigma z over t1. So we have a simple piece. Now, of course, it doesn't quite look like the block equations that we wrote up there. But that's okay, because I haven't put in the unitary dynamics, right? Over here, we have a Hamiltonian. And so we need to put in the Hamiltonian. And so let me... Hey, come on. Let me add to this that we're going to look at u of t summation m sub k rho 0 m sub k rho. Right, so now we have a piece to keep that. Now you might say to me, hey, does the order matter? Well, of course the order matters, right? They don't commute with each other. But remember that the map we're looking at is infinitesimal. And so we're going to integrate this up. And as we integrate it up, we'll keep sandwiching rho. So we put the Krauss operators here again, and we put the unitary. We'll keep doing that, right? And so we'll build this up as an expansion. And therefore, hey, if the time is short enough, the fact that they don't commute doesn't matter in whether I start with the Krauss operators or the unitary. Okay? As long as I make that time really short. Yeah? I'm assuming you've all seen this before, of saying that if you have and you try to approximate it as that, you need to add a correction term for the commutator. Yeah? If you haven't seen that, just spend a few minutes and work it out. Okay. Okay, so we need to add the unitary piece. And the unitary piece, u of t, is e to the I omega over 2. Sigma z times t. And of course, we can just multiply this out, or if you like, you can recall that this is equal to, in fact, it's even better. You can calculate it, you don't have to recall it. Yeah. Hey. That would be correct. Yeah, and so we see what happens. Well, sigma x goes to, under this Hamiltonian, cosine of omega t sigma x plus sine omega t sigma y. Sigma y goes to cosine of omega t sigma y minus sine omega t sigma x. And so we add that dynamics to our differential equations. Then we get these terms directly. And the relaxation times change, right? Because as the system is evolving, we said that the noise is about only the x-axis. So as our vector, as our density matrix, is rotating in the transverse plane, when it's along the x-axis, it doesn't see any noise. When it's along the y-axis, it sees noise. And so the total noise it sees is, in fact, half the noise that it would have been otherwise, right? It says half the time it sees nothing, half the time it sees the noise. So instead of having these values, we replace that with d sigma x dt is equal to minus sigma x over twice t1, right, half the noise, and d sigma y dt is equal to minus sigma y over twice t1, right? And so we get that the noise acts on both states because the rotation of the Zeeman interaction mixes those two. And then there's still a separation here, right? We have we have this term correct. We get that from the Hamiltonian. The Z rotation, the Z term decays just like it should. Right? So we get this term, we're not looking at that term. But these two terms have a factor of a half in there. And why is that? What's the difference between our model and Bloch's model? I know it's not fair. You didn't read Bloch's paper, right? Well, Bloch is looking at noise along both the x and the y direction. So for Bloch's model, I need to add another noise source. About sigma y. And if I do that, of course, then I need to change the probability that nothing happens, right? Because we have these two probabilities, and remember, all of our probabilities better add up to one. Yeah? Okay, so now that we have a nice little picture that says, yes, this is how we get Bloch's equations for the dynamics in these systems. Now, you will see in the literature really strong statements that T1 is greater than or equal to T2, or you'll see a very general statement that T1 is greater than or equal to T2 over 2. And it depends upon what the physical system is. So if you're looking at magnetic resonance, where the Hamiltonian is cylindrically symmetric, then you don't have a right to choose that the X and Y noise are different, right? You're sitting in this cylindrically symmetric space. In which case, this better be right. Okay, so for cylindrical symmetry. But if, on the other hand, you're looking at a two-dimensional system. So you have a two-dimensional electron system, or you have a superconducting qubit. It's two-dimensional because you have a two-dimensional superconducting film. In a two-dimensional system, that's the right model. Okay, and unfortunately, we just use the same terms for those. Okay. So let's see where we are. We said that we have some physics, and the physics is going to include things like the Hamiltonian. It'll include things like the distribution that we're looking at. It better include some piece of a Hamiltonian that depends upon that distribution. It might include things like T1 and T2. Okay, so some piece of this. In all of this, you can integrate and come up with a super operator, or you can integrate it and come up with a set of Krauss operators. And it's trivial to go this way, and you can go back the other way through the Choi matrix that you saw in your tutorial, right? But of course, once you have these things, you're never going to be able to go back to here, right? You can create a model of what goes on here, but there's an infinite number of models that would give you the same result. Okay, now, it looks like this probability distribution is something fundamental is going to prevent us from doing quantum information processing. We say, oh yes, I've got this distribution of unitaries. I'm going to apply some operation to them. I'm going to get some complicated map described by a super operator. It's going to take me inside the block sphere, and therefore I'm going to lose purity, and I won't be able to do quantum computing because we say, hey, we need to keep purity of one, you know, we'll allow you to take away a part in 10 to the 6, maybe, or if we're very generous, a part in 10 to the 4, but we will demand that we keep high purity. So it seems like we're dead, and that's not the case. That if the probability distribution is static, then it does not limit the fidelity with which we can implement an operation. And I want to give you an example of that. So let's say that I want to apply 180-degree rotation about the y-axis. So we'll look again in the block sphere picture. And if, so this is the operator like so. And if we're sitting up here in the zero state on the block sphere, then what we'd like to do is rotate it down to get into the one state on the block sphere. All right. It turns out that in every physical system, we end up having a noise. We have a noise in the angle that we rotate through. So instead of applying this, we end up applying some rotation like that, where epsilon is controlled by some probability distribution. So we end up smearing out the piece. And you can see what happens if we allow epsilon to have a range of values, will end up over some arc. And if I average the dynamic over that arc, then of course I'm going to take that point, I'm going to move it into the interior of the block sphere. And so we'll lose purity over the system. We can replace this by this rotation. Say minus x. We can replace it by three rotations. And of course, what we're saying here is that in practice, what we're going to do is look at those three rotations. And remember our discussion yesterday that said if we have multiple actions and we have a probability distribution, you can't take each action separately and integrate over those probability distributions. You have to integrate the whole action over the probability distributions. Okay? So we see what happens. So it says that instead of rotating it this way, the first thing we're going to do, I'm going to go from this way to that way, it's symmetric, but that's the way I'm going to go anyways, is we're going to rotate about the minus x-axis by pi over 2. And I'll just take epsilon to be some positive number, so we don't quite get to the y-axis, right? If epsilon was 0, we would, of course, get exactly to the y-axis. And then we apply this pi rotation. Now, I've subtracted 2 epsilon because that's the way the physics normally works, that the size of the error is linearly proportional to the angle that you're rotating through. All right. So we're going to rotate about y. And we don't quite get back to the ZY plane, right? We started off in the ZY plane. We don't quite get back to the ZY plane, but we come pretty close. But you can see that we've made up some of those errors. And now we continue a rotation about the x-axis, and we come down towards there, and we get closer to the minus z axis, right? And let me, it's easy enough to go through the math in general and see that. But actually, it's even easier just to calculate the whole thing and let Mathematica tell you. So I'll give you this notebook to have a look at. When it comes up, you can have a look at it here. The way I calculated this, just to give you a different experience, is I calculated it as rotation matrices in O3. Okay, so it's, you know, easy enough to actually calculate this unitary in general and just propagate it through. But you could also quite easily say that a rotation about the x-axis in O3 by some angle theta and I'll try to get my sign right again. Let's see. So x is taking z into minus y. So we calculate it that way. And so now then we look, and what I've plotted here is the projection along the z-axis for a state transfer. So we start with the state in the zero state, and then we look at the projection along the z-axis as a function of the angle of a y rotation. And of course, at pi, we get exactly what we want. And then in the lower one, what I've plotted is what happens when we apply the composite rotation. And now in the composite rotation, you see just what you want, that over some range of errors, you come very close to having to reaching the one state just as you should. And you know, it's not going to surprise you that that with some cost of extra effort, you can make this bigger and bigger. And of course, we could blow it up and see that it isn't exactly minus one. And you can make it closer and closer to minus one, right? So that there's and we can look at the trajectories, of course. You can play with that to your heart's content and see that that's yes, all this stuff works as it should. Okay, so we'll get rid of that. Actually, I don't know how to get rid of the board. But maybe the people in the back will get rid of the board for me. Or maybe not. So we've got this description now of a spin 1/2 particle. We've seen that that there's different ways that it can evolve. It can evolve unitarily, it can evolve in an open system dynamic. And now I want to go back to the neutron interferometry case and apply these ideas. And with the little bit of time I have left, we're going to see if you can't figure out an experiment. Oh, let me say one more thing. So this composite pulse, so it's called a composite pulse. This idea of an open loop control to define sets of complicated unitaries that improve the fidelity of some process. This is a very well worked out field. And if we know the error, we know that it's time independent. That's essential. So it's reproducible. If we know that we have a reproducible error, we know how it comes in, we know what our resources are, then we can develop methods. You can just run a program. You can spit out the methods that will achieve fidelities that are arbitrarily high. Now, of course, what happens is that it takes a very short sequence and it makes it longer and longer and longer. So if I look at the block equation pictures, you know, as I make things longer and longer, T1 and T2 are still in effect, right? And so we're going to lose by those irreversible processes. Okay. But usually you can win much more than you lose by those. Okay, so we have those control schemes. Now then, we go back to neutron interferometry. And we remind you of what we're doing here. We're saying that we have a neutron coming in, that it interacts with the blade and is divided. We end up with a coherent superposition coming out of that blade. These act as mirrors. We put some phase flag in here. I put it like that. Remember that it really only, this is what it really is. Remember that we get a phase because of the difference in path length over those two. And we recombine at the third blade. And then we have two detectors, O and H, that see all the neutrons. Okay. So when I was starting to play with these things at NIST, there was a debate in the group. The debate was, if you put a magnetic field here, what happens to the contrast? And it's like a lot of debates that I see going on in physics communities. People are really happy to sit around and argue about it. But no one ever wants to just go back and do the calculation. So you know, we're going to do two things. We can argue about it. That's fun. But you know, nature's not going to change any result based upon our arguments, right? At some point, you should calculate it and see what the answer is. Now, of course, having a magnetic field there, a neutron, of course, is not charged. It's neutral. But it does have a magnetic moment. And so the particle here has some magnetic moment. And, of course, it has a spin. It's a spin 1/2. Spin 1/2 system. And for the incoming beam, we're in this particular experiment, we're not controlling the spin. So the spin is as likely to be up as it is to be down. So from the spin degree of freedom, it's in a fully mixed state. So then I could say, oh yes, I have, in fact, two elements of my distribution. The spin is up and the spin is down, right? Don't really like that piece. Let me rewrite it. Because I don't want you to think that there's a coherence, right? So then we're saying that, hey, we know that the neutron is in that path, right? And then there's a tensor product to the identity over the spin state. And we can rewrite the identity operator as being, I'm going to use up and down for the spins. Right? So there's no coherence. There's no off-diagonal elements of this. Right? If I reached in and grabbed a neutron, it's either going to be pointed up or it's going to be pointed down, and it's going to be 50-50 at a time. And if I looked along X, I would see the same thing. If I looked along Y, I would see the same thing. Okay? We just have it in this nice identity state. Good. Now, what's going to happen when we have a field? And let's put the field along the Z direction. What's going to happen when we put have our neutron moving through this field? What's the piece that we care about? Okay, so the neutron is a spin 1/2 particle. A spin 1/2 particle is a bar magnet, right? Good. And if I take a bar magnet and I put it into a magnetic field, what happens? Okay, so there's an energy difference between being up and being down, right? Okay. So during this period here, we'll have a potential that depends upon the spin state. Right? And the neutron's going to come in with one of these spins, up or down. Right? And there's a potential there. The neutron's going through here. Just think about the neutron as a plane wave. You know, let your mind drift back to solving Schrodinger's equation. What happens if I add a potential? What happens to the wave number? to make you guys solve Schrodinger's equation? The velocity depends upon the difference between the energy of the particle and the potential, right? So if you have a potential, then the velocity of the neutrons in the upstate is different than the velocity of the neutrons in the downstate. Okay. What happens to the contrast in this experiment? Now, the signal that we measure here, these detectors don't care about spin, right? So we have a helium-3 detector, but the helium-3 is not polarized. So it's going to count neutrons regardless of spin. Back and say one more thing. Here we have the silica piece, which is a phase flux, right? U is equal to e to the I phi, and I'll say over 2 e to the minus I phi over 2, 0, 0, right? The difference in phases in those. Those phases are associated with what? They're associated with the potential of the neutron traveling through this media of the silica. So the reason we get this phase difference is that the neutron is slowed down as it goes from air into the silica, right? And so if I think about the neutron as a plane wave, then we can say, oh yes, I've got a plane wave, but this one's slowed down. It's retarded when it arrives here. So they arrive slightly out of phase, right? And that's the phase that dictates the interference effect that we see here. All right, that's enough hints. What happens?
Phase change.
Say it out loud.
Phase change.
And when the phase change, what happens? Good. So we're saying the phase changes. And I want you to say another phrase. Dependent on? Yes, you get a prize. So we end up with an outcome that has two different results here. One for the spin upstate and one for the spin downstate. And when I add those two together, what am I going to see? The contrast will decrease. Life is good. Okay, so now we can explicitly calculate this. We know the unitary for this. We know the unitary for this. We know the unitary for this, right? The unitary for this says that there's e to the I. I think I call it b. B for field, I guess. Like that. There's some phase shift, and this thing depends upon spin. We'll see how I'm going to use that. And we know that this is the same as that. And we know the operators here, that this is the projector in the upstate, and this is the projector in the downstate. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to do the calculation without having to add spin as another qubit. Because nothing actually interesting happens to spin. Spin never gets rotated, right? The spin is just giving us a potential. So what we're going to do is we're just going to add two experiments. We'll add the experiment when the spin is up to the experiment when the spin is down. Since there's no coherence and the spin isn't rotated, we're allowed to do that. And later on, we'll see that we're going to use spin for something more interesting. Okay, so then when the spin is up, let's put a positive and negative here. E to the I plus minus B. That's lousy. E to the plus minus IB, that's better. We'll choose the plus sign when the spin is up, the minus sign when the spin is down. We'll go ahead and calculate those things. It's all written up there. And now here's the result. As we look at the intensity of the outcoming beam as a function of this parameter B, and I show both the O and the H beam intensity. And this, of course, is the phase of the phase flag, right? So I'm going to rotate the phase flag, and we'll move between those. And of course, if B is equal to zero, life is easy. And then as I increase B, the contrast is reduced. And it's reduced in a very rapid way. It actually goes to zero. What happens? What's the condition under which this thing goes to zero?
The phases pi
out. Absolutely, right. So it says that we've rotated exactly out of phase. And what's going to happen if I increase the field again? They'll come back. So as I increase the field, we return the contrast. And it's a little bit nicer to see this. Yeah, it's okay. It's a little bit nicer to see this if I divide the two experiments. So in this case, what we're looking at is the outcome for the spin up neutrons, the outcome for the spin down neutrons, and of course, the central line is exactly the average of those two, which is the average of the experiment. And so we can see that, in fact, at no point do we actually lose contrast in this device. Our measurement doesn't reveal the contrast, but fundamentally, we haven't lost contrast. And that's why, with these composite rotations, we can always find a solution that actually returns the full fidelity that takes us back to the surface of the Bloch sphere. So for this experiment, what should I do in order to go from this result to that result? There's a few answers. Say that again? Sure. So one way of doing it is to measure the spin here. We can do that by something called a super mirror. We scatter neutrons at very low angle off nickel, and it depends upon the angle depends upon the spin state. Yeah.
Can we measure those which ignore them and then do something
else? Can we measure what?
The middle mirror is just the reflector. There are some things which go out and we can measure.
Here.
Yeah.
So you say, if I measure these, I'm bypassing that, right? Is that the deal? But somehow I need to bring these back into the interferometer. Mm. Right? I need to so if I just measured here, or I just measured here, then what would I see? Half the time I would see a neutron. But I wouldn't see any interference, right? I would see a neutron or I wouldn't see a neutron. And if I measure here, does it matter what I do with this phase flag? Absolutely not. That's exactly right. So one way of doing this is, as you say, detect the spin here. Another way, what could you do here? You could prepare the spin. And an easy way of preparing the spin is to take a little pool of helium-3 that's spin polarized. 3, 3, 3. and it'll capture all of the down neutrons. And only those neutrons that have the same spin as the helium-3 will make it through. What happens if I put the magnetic field over both paths? What happens to the contrast? Yeah, you recover the contrast for everything, right? Because it says that the magnetic phase becomes a global phase. And so we don't see any influence of that. Annoyingly, in order to convince the people at NIST, and they're great people, but we actually had to do the experiment. And, you know, hopefully you were convinced without me doing the experiment. But we did the experiment to convince them, and of course, it works. So here we control the spin degree of freedom and look at the contrast in those two. Important, because we were exploring putting another experiment next to it. And it would have put a magnetic field gradient over our experiment. That magnetic field gradient would have cost us contrast. And you know, you can see on this axis over here that for each of these points, we're counting 100 seconds. And you know, 100 seconds, then we get 200 counts. We can't afford to lose any contrast. So we don't do that. Okay. I'm supposed to stop. So what I'd like you to do is to take this simple model and then go ahead and calculate the Krauss picture for it. Okay? So now we have a distribution. It's a real simple one to calculate over because there's just two elements. So go ahead and look at the Krauss and the superoperator description of this, okay? And see that you get out this nice set of physics out of that. And then we'll still return to the neutron interferometer to get just a little bit more about the physics of the system, but really what I want to do now is to use the spin for what it is a good qubit, and to say, okay, what happens when we have two spins, and we can start to ask questions about entanglement instead of just one spin, and we can only ask questions about superposition and interference effects. Any questions?
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned being worried about a magnetic field gradient.
Yeah.
I was assuming this was a homogeneous magnetic
field. It is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it gets even worse, right?
Right, because they won't overlap anymore, right?
Yeah, so if I have a magnetic field which is stronger here and weaker here, but of course it's also, you know, this... the beam is thick, so even over the beam, we can see the variation in the magnetic field.
Right.
And so you know, all of it is easy to model and see what the effects are, and at the end of the day, we're not a. If we have this geometry of an interferometer, it's susceptible to variations in the magnetic field. Okay, this geometry of an interferometer is susceptible to everything. And we'll get to the point where I'll show you a different version of the interferometer, which is less susceptible to most noise.
Okay.